Can you start by saying your name and your various hats?
Okay, so I'm David Stewart, and I am joint head of the Division of Structural Biology in the Nuffield Department of Medicine.
Known as Struby.
Known as Struby, yes, that's right. And I'm also, so I'm, for quite a long time, I've been significantly funded by the Medical Research Council, so they actually fund a large part of my salary as a MRC professor, and that's 50% of my time, and then the other 50% of my time is life science director at the Diamond Synchrotron, which is half an hour down the road from here. And I've been the life science director at Diamond for quite a long time now, over 10 years. And until the end of last year, until the end of 2021, I was also the director of InstructERIC, which is a pan-European structural biology research infrastructure, which I wasn't formally paid for, but because the UK is a member country, my contribution was part of the MRC's contribution to InstructERIC. I stopped doing that at the end of 2021.
Well, I think we're going to talk about all of those things soon. But can we start by just very briefly telling me how you got to where you are now, starting from your earliest interest in biological sciences and then structural biology?
Okay, well, that could be sort of quite long.
Well, we need to keep it short.
Yes. So I started off, my first degree was in biophysics at King's College in London. And I became interested at that point in methods for looking at structures. And Maurice Wilkins was the head of department. And I discussed things with him as well. I was interested in the sort of sociology of science as well, but I decided to do a PhD and did that at Bristol University, and that was in X-ray crystallography, so looking at the structure of proteins. At that point there weren't a huge number of protein structures that had been done, and I worked on the structure of an enzyme, a glycolytic enzyme, one of the basic sort of enzymes that manages the metabolism of cells and is used throughout biology. So I did that for my PhD. Then I was at a loss really what to do. I came here to Oxford for a short period, but during that period I was organising to go and work in China, and I was supported in that by Dorothy Hodgkin and David Phillips. And then I went out to work in Beijing on, again, structural biology. In that case, mainly looking at versions of insulin, derivative of insulin, with the insulin group in China that had very strong links with Dorothy in Oxford. That was in the early 1980s, so there wasn't the same sort of social media there is now. So I was lucky that the end of that, I was offered a postdoc to return to Oxford by Louise Johnson. So I came back and started with Louise, and then after a relatively short time, I applied for a lectureship that came up in Oxford and got a permanent position. And when I was starting my group, I sort of had to decide what to do, and it was a time when there was some developments in virology. There was an excellent virology group at the Purbright Institute, which was, you know, it's not that far from Oxford, and the person leading that group contacted David Phillips and said, look, we're trying to make a better vaccine, or make a useful vaccine for foot and mouth disease virus, and we think the structure would be interesting. And David Phillips directed me to work with them, which was very sort of generous, and he was very supportive of that. So that moved me and gave me the opportunity to do something which at the time was quite ambitious, which was to do the structure of a complete virus. So that put me into the sort of direction of doing structural virology. And in the early years, I worked on foot and mouth disease virus, and also worked on it because at the time also there was the HIV epidemic came about. So the MRC set up an AIDS-directed program of research, and we collaborated with the pharmaceutical sort of branch of Wellcome because they were doing some, they produced the first of the antiviral drugs. So we were collaborating with them on the structure of the reverse transcriptase, which was the primary drug target at that time, along with the protease. So I got into trying to help people working in industry on drug design, and got into working with the people also in industry, Fred Brown and Dave Rowlands at Wellcome, with the idea of using structure to help in vaccine design.
So let's just unpack that a little bit. I mean, first of all, very basic question. Why is it important to know about the three-dimensional structure of something like a virus or a protein?
Well, there's a fundamental biology, and there's two things there, and David Baltimore got the Nobel Prize for discovering retroviruses many years ago, and what he said was that the fantastic thing about viruses is that they are biology sort of stripped down to the minimum. So you can argue about whether they're alive or not, but they have an evolutionary history. So in that sense, they're really the sort of simplest embodiment of life. So you can see Darwinian sort of evolution at work, and in the case of the pandemic, in sort of real time, you know. So their genome is very small. So an RNA virus, most RNA viruses are not very accurate. Their polymerase that copies their genome makes errors, so they can only support a relatively simple genome. So there's a small number of proteins. A lot of the complications of cell life they don't do. They don't make their own energy and stuff like that. So from my perspective, they're a really interesting system because you can have this sort of crazy idea that you can sort of understand them in a more complete way than you would a very complicated cell. So that's the sort of fundamental science. And then, of course, there's also the sort of health impact, and that's human and animal health. To understand the basic science of something like a virus, structure, I think everybody recognizes now that's a sort of key aspect to hang your understanding on. And for the therapeutic side, as I say, the sort of two aspects, major aspects, I think, are the vaccines and then the therapeutics, either small molecules or biologics. And in a sense, both of those structure should be important. And for small molecule drug design, the argument is accepted really by the drug companies. All the major drug companies have a large activity in the area, and Steve Burley, the head of the protein database in Rutgers in the US, did an analysis, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but well over half of the drugs coming to market now have used structure at some point in their development.
And this is just because you've got two things that have to interact.
Yes, so if you're trying to design a small molecule that's going to bind to a protein, usually a protein target, and stop it working. So, in the case of the HIV, we've got the key enzyme reverse transcriptase that's responsible for allowing the virus to incorporate into the host genome. So you have little chemical pieces that are like the chemical fragments that the virus uses to make replicate the genome, which bind but then inactivate the enzyme. So the whole sort of basis of that success is based on the physicochemical recognition of a large molecule by a small compound. And you can imagine you can do it all by chance, but it was very inefficient. And beyond that, in principle, what happens with viruses, because as I say, the error rate of the polymerase is very high, the virus is able to mutate very quickly and escape from antibodies or escape from small molecule therapeutics very often. And that's one of the things that with the HIV story, we found that extremely quickly. And that was something that was I was very impressed with, was the way that even though Welcome, they produced a drug and they thought that they were hoping to sell this and hoping for it to be effective. As soon as they discovered, and they discovered it very quickly because the resistance comes up very quickly in tissue culture, they were completely open about it and made all the information available. But that escape, again, is explicable in terms of the simple physicochemical processes. There's a mutation in the viral protein, and you might have a bigger protein side chain that's put in there by the mutation that then blocks the binding of the small molecule drug. So one of the questions that we were looking at with Welcome and the one of the students that was looking at this was Andrew Hopkins, who's now the CEO of Exscientia, one of the local drug companies, can you build into your compound design a way of reducing the chance that the virus can escape from it? And it's not a trivial question, it's still an open question, but in principle, if you have the structural information, you've got the tools then to start to think about those questions. So the structure is important for the small molecules, and the same with antibodies, biological therapeutics. We'll probably discuss this later. One of the things that we wanted to understand is how the virus changes to avoid recognition by antibodies that the people generate. That again is a very simple thing. There's a recognition of the viral protein by the antigen, and if you make a mutation in the viral protein, if it's well designed, you can prevent the antibody binding. And then the vaccine side, because my feeling from the beginning was that it should be possible to improve the properties of the antigen, which is the vaccine, to make more successful vaccines. And there's various ways that you can go about doing that. You can get rid of the genetic material from a vaccine, so you're not producing vast amounts of live virus, so it becomes safe. And that then also reduces the requirement that the antigen is capable of supporting life in a sense, so you can make changes to it that stabilize it and making it a better vaccine, but would be incompatible with it being a replicating virus.
So the recognition sites tend to be on the, yes, the sort of outside envelope, yes, of the virus, yes, whereas the genetic material is on the,
yes,
inside.
Yes.
If you can take it out, you've still,
exactly,
got it.
Yeah. You can throw that away, and in principle, if you do it right, it doesn't affect the what is seen by the immune system at all.
We should just very quickly go over the tools that you use. So you started out in X-ray crystallography, and you're also involved with electron microscopy, and these are ways of trying to see things that are smaller than the wavelength of light.
Yes, and viruses were not seen at all until electron microscopy was invented in the 1930s, and I think it was only about 8 years after the electron microscope was invented that Ruska, the person that built the first microscope, looked and saw a virus for the first time. So electron microscopes were needed to see them at all, and that was a really important thing, to, because a lot of the classification of viruses was based on the morphological characters seen in the EM. But that was at much too poor a level of detail to be able to help in drug design or vaccine design, because you couldn't see the sort of chemical basis of them. So that's why crystallography became the first method to really sort of open up virus structures. And because compared to, so crystallography started with Bragg looking at salt and
yes,
very
simple things.
Yes, let's
not do the whole
things.
History of crystallography, because no. I just don't think we're going to have enough time.
No, no.
So what do you do as a modern crystallographer what are you using?
The point is that crystallography started off with very simple things.
Yes.
And a virus is probably of something like two orders of magnitude more complicated than a protein, which is where crystallography, you know, what its bread and butter was a few years ago. So I was interested because it was sort of quite challenging to do crystallography on it, but it's perfectly possible to do it if you can get the crystals. That gives you a crystal structure with atomic detail, so that's very useful. But then you still have to grow a crystal, so which can be problematic, and you get a single structure out of that, which is the crystal structure. Cryo-electron microscopy really sort of completely changed from a sort of ability to recognize morphology to see atomic detail, with a series of improvements in the electron microscopes, in the ways the electrons were detected, and the ways the samples were presented. The electrons interact much more strongly with matter than X-rays, so the sample has to be extremely thin, otherwise the electrons are completely absorbed.
And extremely cold. That's what the
and
the cryo.
They have to be cold at cryo, and that's the in general what we learned from X-ray crystallography was that we get a 100-fold greater lifetime of the crystal of a biological sample, because electrons and X-rays are both damaging of biological samples, so they destroy the chemistry ultimately, and that's the limitation compared to material science. So on the other hand, with electron microscopy, if your sample, the key thing there is the electron microscope has to be at very high vacuum, and if you just had a biological sample in liquid in high vacuum, the liquid would evaporate. And also the sample would move around. So there's the real sort of advantage there is that you sort of freeze and make the sample stationary. You put it in a very thin film of water. So you by proteins and also viruses very often need to stay hydrated, otherwise they become inactivated. So you can do that with this process of vitrification, which just means that instead of cooling the water down slowly and getting ice crystals, you cool it very quickly and it forms a glass, which then doesn't disturb the proteins and viruses that you want to look at. So in the electron microscope, you get these very thin vitrified cryo specimens. You have a very beautiful sort of beam of electrons, and you have a very high quality detector. And over the last 10 years, that's completely transformed the capability of the method, and it's not finished, that transformation process. There's still more to go in the future, I think.
And I think we just need a very quick one-sentence description of what synchrotrons enable you to do that you couldn't do with the old-fashioned X-ray methods.
Yeah, synchrotrons
such
give...
as diamond.
Yeah, I mean, diamond... synchrotron. A lot of the synchrotron developments actually sort of came about in the UK. Diamond allows you to, it gives you a source of X-rays that is all many orders of magnitude brighter than a lab source or sort of hospital X-ray source, and that means that you can essentially tackle structures such as viruses that would be almost impossible by a normal lab source. So it's transformed it. And in terms of the SARS response and the virology response, that increased brightness of the beam means that you can collect a data set for instance, a viral protein in perhaps 2 minutes at the synchrotron. So it alters the whole, it's a game changer in that rather than just look at a single structure, you can think about looking at many hundreds of structures of the target with a number of different chemicals bound, and then you can help, then you can much more quickly learn what the basis of the recognition is and improve the chemical design.
Brilliant. So that's a wonderful introduction to virology and structural studies and your career so far. But so finally we get to COVID. Can you remember where you were, what you were doing, or how you first heard that something was going on in China, and when you came to realise that it was something that you were going to have to engage with?
It's a tricky one, because there's often things happening around the world with viruses, and there was the first hint that something was happening, I guess, before the end of the year in 2019. But it wasn't at all obvious to me that this was going to develop into a problem. It did in January 2020 started to become clear that this was serious, and my group at that time weren't working on coronaviruses. We'd done some work on SARS when that outbreak occurred, but so we were not. It wasn't something that we were particularly attuned to. So we were probably, I guess, perhaps I thought, well, you know, unless this is really going to be a big thing, we'll carry on doing what we're doing. But I got a call from a colleague of mine, Rao Zehe, in China, fairly late in January. And they, by that point, it was clear that this was serious. So we were thinking, how should we engage with this? And Rao was some other PIs were the first people to do a structure of a SARS-CoV-2 protein, which was the main protease, which is the target for the Roche drug, for instance, at the moment. So he phoned up because partly we do stay in touch, but in particular, they'd got the structure, and they worked extraordinarily quickly. As soon as the sequence was available, they made the synthetic gene for the protein they wanted to work on. They'd driven to the place where the gene was made and brought it back, and within a few days had got crystals, because they'd worked on the SARS and the MERS versions of this that gave them a lot of sort of insight, because it's a related protein. So they're able to get a structure very quickly, and they started to sort of think about how they might look at designing compounds that would inactivate it. But then they were using the synchrotron in China, the Shanghai synchrotron, and like any synchrotron, it runs in sort of cycles. You have a run and you have a shutdown period, and they had a shutdown period coming up, so he got in touch to see if there was a way of collaborating with Diamond to sort of keep things moving along. And because of the difficulty of sort of exchanging things, materials, what actually happened was we ended up using the information from them to resynthesize everything over here, but essentially using all of their knowledge that they gained. And we set up a program at Diamond, because over the years we set up a system at Diamond called XChem, which is basically adding a lab onto adjacent to the beamline, so that people can come in and use pre-made libraries of small chemical fragments, which can then be dispensed at very high throughput and sort of quickly and easily and reliably onto protein crystals. And then there's a system for helping people prepare those crystals and get them ready for the synchrotron, and then those get shipped onto the very high throughput beamline. So that was that process was set in motion very early on. The cloning and crystallization work was led by Martin Walsh at Diamond, my deputy at Diamond, and then the person that leads the XCAM project, Frank von Delft, whose joint appointment here with Department of Medicine, was involved in the making sure the XCAM stuff worked efficiently.
And this was this just looking at the main protease, or were you looking at other proteases?
Initially, it was just the one thing,
yeah,
because we just wanted to get something up and running, and we didn't have any extra money for this, so we just had to sort of people just repurposed what they were doing, and then we'll worry about it afterwards, you know. So that was set up initially, yeah, and that went very quickly, and the results, and just and Rao, as soon as he got the structure, actually he made the structure available even before the protein data bank had sort of been over it, and it takes a week or so to review it and then make it available. So he made it available immediately to people, and then it was put on the PDB very quickly. So in the same way with the fragment screen, as soon as the results came through, they were made available from Diamond before they were could be sort of put on the PDB, because when you get large amounts of data for these things, it doesn't fit into the deposition method for the protein data bank very well, so it was easier to make a special sort of site that people could take the data from. And then that was to sort of let people know about that. It was that really took off through Twitter rather than anything else. And Martin sort of told people on Twitter about this, and it was a time when probably a significant number of medicinal chemists that were not able to go into work, so they picked upon the information that was there, and essentially there was this sort of moonshot project that sort of fell together with people around the world, particularly sort of led by groups in America, but initially driven by this work in Diamond, and that that meant that the medicinal chemists could look at the results and come up with ideas, come up with the next generation of compounds that should be better, because the first compounds you get out of a procedure like that are very poor, very weak binders, but you get something quickly and you get quite a lot of results to give you hints. And then there was also a company that makes chemicals sort of engaged as well to help get the next generation of compounds made, and that was the company Enamine, which is a company based in the north of Kyiv, so that they've not been in action recently, but they were extraordinarily helpful in this process, and that then sort of went on. And of course, you know, at each stage you can, there's different things needed, and I think the process sort of it was done in a sort of open way, not in a company, so. At each stage, for the next stage, there had to be a sort of collaboration set up, or you had to, you know, how do you do the assays had to be set up, and that was done, particularly people in Oxford. Chris Schofield was great in that, and is great, and Chris is still very heavily involved in lots of aspects of this. It's also spawned further work. So there's now some NIH projects that were launched a week or two ago, which Oxford and Diamond are heavily involved in, where the NIH recognise that they want to expand this sort of activity to cover not just SARS-CoV-2, but to think about other viruses that are potential pandemic threats. So that took off, but of course. Because Diamond is a user facility, there were lots of people came in with expertise in other proteins, and over the period, I think most of the obvious targets within SARS-CoV-2 have been looked at now, and several of those are going forward. But
so the protein that most people seem to hear about is the spike protein. That's the one.
Oh, that's not really a drug target.
That's
what we're.
That's
what
we
worked on here.
It as well.
Yes. No, we've done a huge amount of the
spike
protein.
So tell me that story.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, because I'm interested in the structure of whole viruses, and the spike is a key component on the virus. The spike is the protein that recognizes receptors on the cell. So it's,
and each virus has lots of spikes, presumably.
Yes, there's a good, there's a good one. But no, there's quite a lot. I mean, how many is? There's probably still the sort of subject of some discussion, but there's a good number of spikes on, and each spike, it's attached at one end into the virus. The virus has a membrane which surrounds it, and the spike has a little tail that is anchored in the membrane, and then there's a substantial amount of protein. It's a big protein. It's a trimer, so there's three protein chains that are identical to each other arranged in a cluster, and at the top of the spike there is one particular bit, only about a sixth of the total protein, about 200 residues out of 1200, that is critical for binding to the sort of main, I guess, or you know, really key internalization receptor, which is called ACE2. So this is a molecule on the on our cells that the virus has to recognize to get into the cell. So that recognition event is critical for cell entry by the virus. Once that's happened, then the rest of the protein has a different job to do, which is to get the virus into the cell. And that it does that by a series of conformational changes that essentially anchor the virus to the host membrane, and then pull the two membranes together so that the viral genome is released into the host cell, causing
like
the infection.
Yeah.
So that, but all of that depends on the initial recognition of the receptor via this the receptor binding domain, RBD as it's known, on the top of the spike. So the spike has three of these sitting on the top, and they're little little domains that can move around. When they move up, they expose the bit that binds to the ACE2 receptor. When they're down, they can't see the receptor. So it's a complicated dynamic process, and clearly you might expect that antibodies that would bind to the place where the receptor normally binds would block the entry of the virus, and so those would be so-called neutralizing antibodies. So that's been entirely borne out by a huge amount of work that's followed.
And all the things you've just told me just now, did we know all that already from studies of other coronaviruses, or has that come about?
We knew the basics as soon as the sequence came out, you could align it with the first SARS virus, so that's why it was relatively simple to name it. And not all coronaviruses have the same receptor binding domain structure, but SARS has something that's pretty similar. And in fact, there are one or two antibodies that neutralize SARS that can also neutralize SARS-CoV-2. They're very, very small number, but it's sufficiently similar that there are, you know, recognizable structural things that some antibodies can co-recognize between the two viruses. So most of that was, and that knowledge was absolutely critical for a lot of the things that followed. If we'd have started from scratch, it would have slowed everything down. But so again, just as Rao had experience with the enzyme, there was experience from other groups on doing structural biology of spikes of SARS and MERS, which they knew that these were difficult proteins to work with, and they knew that there were some tricks that you could do to stabilize the protein, make it easier to work with. So those, and you know, hold it in the trimeric form when it's taken off the virus or expressed without the virus. And so there was a series of things that could immediately be applied from what we knew about the other viruses to making this. It was still, it's still a big and you know, slightly floppy protein. It was still not trivial to make high quality reagents, and that was really quite important. It was very important to be able to do that. And in the early days, there was a lot of stuff that, you know, there were some low quality reagents around, which somewhat muddied the waters with some of the work. And the Struby is the big strengths in structural biology in Struby are sort of twofold. One is the structural virology, and the other is cell surface proteins. And the cell surface proteins are the cell version of the spike, essentially. They're not the same, but the problems are similar. So they are proteins that have a lot of sugars on the outside. They are associated with membranes, and they need to be made in special ways. So we were in a good position to have experts in making these proteins. So we had in the very, very early days, Yu Guang, who's a sort of postdoc that's worked with me and also with Yvonne. He looked at this and came up with designs for the protein based on other people's experience. And people in America were doing the same thing, and we sort of used their ideas and as well, and were able to make the protein relatively quickly, get the protein in the right formulation and stable enough to do to do structural work by electron microscopy. Took a bit of time, but we got there. And as I say, there was a lot of groups were working on it, and the information was shared very rapidly because the journals have responded very quickly in terms of the peer review process. So there's been very compared to sometimes when it might take a year to get the paper through the whole thing, it's been turned around very quickly because everybody's recognised the importance. But also the journals encourage people to make the papers available on preprint servers.
Yeah.
So it meant that there was an open exchange of information, which was very good. So we were able to relatively quickly, I can't remember exactly when, but we were able to get some high quality spike and start on structural work. And
what were the main questions that you were seeking to answer about the spike?
Well, I think part of it was getting being able to have the reagents. Because although we're structural biologists, high quality reagents like the spike are useful for a lot of other things. So they're useful for diagnostics, they're useful for serology testing, when we were able to make the stuff, we then were asked for material by a number of companies that were trying to set up tests. Whether it was sort of lateral flow tests or serology tests, so that was something that it was a useful reagent, and we could make reasonable, not massive amounts, but we could make enough of the reagents to give to people to do proof of principle experiments.
Right. So I finally understood. Sorry, I've noticed that your name appears on a lot of these enormous studies.
Right.
That are looking at serology, that are looking at the prevalence of infection in the population. And I hadn't understood why that was, and now I do.
Right. So, but it was sort of one of those things was relatively early on. I was approached by the person that leads biology activity at the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, who I'd known for many years, and he was collaborating with somebody at a hospital in Zurich, and they had a very high throughput serology assay, robotic assay, that they were looking to repurpose, but they didn't have access to the reagents. So we sent them some reagents, and then I established contact with people that were developing the assay. Really, really nice people out there, and also established contact with Daniel Ebner in the Target Discovery Institute, and we sort of, I don't do serology normally, but it just seemed that there was an opportunity to set something up. So Daniel worked really hard to and set aside some of his robotic equipment, and you know we worked with the people in Switzerland, and then because it starts to become you've got to think about how you run this as a project. Diamond donated one of their senior project managers to help sort of set up some of the structures of the thing in the early days, and we set up that a robotic platform to enable us to do a few thousand serology tests a day, and that's now run by Derek Crook.
Yes.
I think it's been successful. These things are always, it's not trivial to do that, mm-hmm. especially in a sort of academic environment. But I think it's contributed some useful information. Mm-hmm. It's provided a lot of data for the Office of National Statistics. So that was one example of the value of the reagent, but then. Yeah, the sort of questions, the thing with structural biology is you don't quite know what the questions, it's often not entirely hypothesis driven, but discovery science sometimes. So one of the things was, what will we learn by doing it? And one of the things that we did wonder was whether there was the possibility for you designing small molecule therapeutics against the spike, and that's proved really difficult, and we've not been successful in that. I thought we were getting close at one point, because we found that within the receptor binding domain there was a little lipid molecule, a little sort of fatty acid that was bound within it, and when the fatty acid was there, the receptor binding domains were locked in a down conformation, so would not be accessible to the to bind the cell. So I thought that might be a way to get if you could replace the fatty acid with something that bound much more tightly, then it could inactivate the virus, and there are precedents for that type of mechanism from other viruses that we work on, but we were never able to reproducibly sort of get the spike in the right conformation. We're never able to reproducibly bind things into the receptor binding domain. Once the lipid comes out, my thought, and I suspect other people probably agree, is that the lipid is put in there as the thing comes out of the cell through a membrane, and then probably slowly falls out, and that would then activate it. But for instance, might help the virus get out of a cell, because it was minimise the chance of reattaching, for instance. So that didn't go anywhere. But we did try, and we collaborated with a company to try and find something. Having said that, at the same time as we stumbled upon this, a group in Bristol observed the same thing, and they've taken that much further, and I think they've demonstrated that the principle that you can inhibit the virus by using that binding site. So in a sense, because they picked this up and they were in a much better position to take it forward, we just sort of let them to it, and good luck. I hope it does something. But
you also looked at the interaction of antibodies.
Well, that was the sort of major thing, really.
Yeah.
And that was that as you hinted, sort of brought together an awful lot of people. So Gavin Screeton and Gavin and Jew have their group in this building. Gavin had moved back to Oxford from Imperial College a little while before, and we'd sat around and said, oh, you know, what can we collaborate on? And he was mainly working on flaviviruses, things like dengue virus at that time, and we had ideas, but we didn't, you know, somehow we were busy with other things. And then when this happened, Gavin's group sort of repurposed, and the spike production and RBD production was, well, I didn't say it was, Yu Guang was involved, but from the beginning it was a joint effort with Gavin's group. So we've worked extraordinarily closely together on this, and so that it was a case of making those reagents, and then that enabled. And Gavin's group were involved in really doing the gold standard serology, not at the such high throughput, but slightly lower throughput, which was then used to calibrate the robotic stuff, but also then underpinned all of the work with the variants and the cohorts of people that had different sort of vaccination histories and infection histories and stuff like that. So there was the serology, but also because of the expertise of his group, they could, where they had access to serum samples, they could then do they could do single cell sequencing from blood and get the sequence of antibodies, and then again using the spike as a sort of a screen, you could filter out those antibodies that interacted with spike, and then the live virus work was set up in the OPIC green suite, because soon after we set up Struby, we got money from Wellcome to set up OPIC, the Oxford Particle Imaging Centre, as a place where we could look at viruses in via electron microscopy in containment. So there's areas where we can, there's an electron microscopy in containment, but there's also tissue culture labs in other parts of.
And this just means a high level of biological safety.
Yeah. So Gavin's group were using those contained labs. So they then again repurposed and set up the work with live virus in there. They also set up work with pseudovirus, which is a sort of safe version where you just take a bit of the spike bit and put it on another biological system. So that all of those pieces were set up. Again, you know, some of these things took longer than you'd hope, but they came together, and so we were also working with we've also worked with other people. Jim Naismith, again, not this wasn't his area of science, but he was he's been developing the camelid antibodies, the nanobody side for some years, particularly with Ray Owens, who was initially we recruited to run the Oxford Protein Production Facility, which then sort of migrated down to Harwell.
Did you say camelid?
Yeah.
This is to do with MERS then, is it?
No. It's just that camels, llamas, camelids have special antibodies. Do you know about the nanobodies?
No, I don't know. Okay.
Because a normal antibody has two chains, a light chain and a heavy chain, and both of those have variable domains, which are the things that are, you know, swapped around genetically to give the variation, and also subjected to somatic mutation in the germinal centres to optimise the interaction. So they're sort of the interaction area is essentially two protein domains. The camelid antibodies just have a subset of their antibodies just have one of those domains, which is called the VHH. So that means that there's a very small bit of protein, it's only 100 residues, you know, it's not that much bigger than insulin, that is responsible for recognition. So that is a useful reagent because it's so tiny. It might, you know, it's the sort of thing that you can imagine giving a via an inhaler or something to get it into the airways. So So this was something that people had been working on for some time, and the Jim had just got, and Ray had just got money to set this up properly. So they switched initially. So we worked closely with them to help initially, and but they got all their own stuff, so they could quickly sort of do everything themselves. And then they worked to develop very high affinity nanobodies as potential therapeutics. And I don't know where that, I'm not sure where that's at. Jim's hoping to get that, I think, into use, but it's not so easy. Mm. The big sort of pharmaceutical companies, they tend to have very well defined pipelines of what they do. So if you fit into their normal sort of expectation of what products are, then it's much easier. Where this is anything a little bit off track is quite a bit slower. So there was that side. Gavin's group could then start to pull out antibodies, and because they got the live virus, all these assays, they could select those that were of high affinity, and then we had the ability to do crystallography to look at the binding of those to the receptor binding domain, and do cryo-electron microscopy to see how they interacted with the spike. So it was an extremely sort of good collaboration, because we just went backwards and forwards, and came up with ideas and tried to sort of understand these things, we started off with the original sort of early pandemic virus, and we've somehow tracked through a lot of work since then.
I notice that it's 11 o'clock and you're supposed to be somewhere else. I'm just going to ask one final question. I just have to skip most of those. Which is really just a summary of what you've learned, really, about how to do science from working in the pandemic. I mean, everything you've told me about has involved massive collaboration and sharing and openness. Was that typical of how you were working before, or do you think there's been a sea change, and will it continue?
I've been really lucky to have had fantastic collaborations and to work with consortia for a long time. So that sort of thing is not new to me. The vaccine work that we do with foot and mouth is with a consortia. The vaccine work on polio is with a consortia. The European work has always been very consortia-like. But what was really good here was that the consortia was sort of joined up and broader than you used to, and Richard Cornell was really sort of made it. I think did some fantastic stuff, because as soon as it was clear what was happening, he set up a sort of group within the Department of Medicine, and we would meet very regularly, and have completely sort of open discussions. And the interactions that I've had with medics and all of these people around has been completely transformed by this, and it made a huge difference, because, as you say, if you look at the people involved, the people that were working with the patients, were getting the consent, making sure that the right samples were obtained, and putting those things together normally is terribly hard. So it was really effective, and that extends to the sort of vaccine work as well. So we'd have these regular meetings, and we'd find out what was happening from Sarah, and I think that there was that was really sort of refreshing to have that, and somebody like Derek Crook. I mean, I knew about him, but I'd never worked with him before. So it's brilliant. You sort of get to know these fantastic people, that's been a really wonderful thing. One of the questions is what happens next? And I think I hope it'll be possible to hold on to the realization that by putting all these pieces together, you can actually sort of progress things through to a much sort of richer outcome than you would if you just look at your own area. But we'll see.